And that is the music that you know so well. And it means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And on this week's show, we're going to tackle a couple of topics, one of which is the NBC musical series Smash. We're also going to talk about something that we don't always spend a lot of time on, which is books and reading. How will we do that? And then, of course, as always, we will talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's introduce the current lineup. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org. And for the purposes of the discussion of Smash, I am also, I hope, your resident theater nerd.
Nice. And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
Pretty much this right now. I'm actually not really writing about books and comic books for the NPR website right now because I'm...
Why, Glenn?
Writing a book.
Oh, wow.
A book. Hey. Writing 12 chapters of a book that is due in 2 months. So, I don't really have much time for that. But normally, writing about books and comic books for the NPR
website. Books and comic books for the NPR website. Well, we will get back to that topic. But first, as Julie Chen likes to say on Big Brother, but first... NBC is just now catching up with the idea of the Glee wave, I think it's fair to say. It takes a while to get a musical series off the ground. And with the success of Glee, which has already decayed into the past success of Glee, NBC is launching a new series called Smash, which is about the staging of a new Broadway musical about Marilyn Monroe. Now, if that doesn't seem perfectly like an obvious topic for a romp... They do have that idea on the show.
Well, as they note in the show, too, it's something that has been tried and failed spectacularly.
So why not do it again? Yeah. That's what we like. So we've all seen it. I watched Smash with Steven, but I'm going to start with Trey because I want to get things off to a positive and happy start. Trey, talk to me, Trey, about your feelings about Smash.
You want to get things off to a knowledgeable start.
You know, I talked a little bit about Smash as perhaps one of the things that was making me happy a couple of months ago when they announced its premiere date.
I think maybe you did.
Because it does have a real theatrical pedigree. The people who put this show together are real theater people. They've got a lot of experience working in the business. Teresa Riebeck, the executive producer of the series, is a notable playwright, but who's also had a long history in film and television, so she lives sort of at the intersection of those worlds. Mark Shaiman, who's writing the songs, and his songwriting partner are the people behind Hairspray and Sister Act and a couple of other things on Broadway. The actors, everybody from Deb Messing, who, you know, all of us know from
Will and Grace,
Got her start in New York theater, and Brian D'Arcy James, who plays her husband, has been in many a Broadway show. It is a solid theater family.
Sort of.
Theater world,
With
one very large exception, as they said in one of the...
So here's the basic setup of Smash. Yeah. You have two young women who are vying for the lead in this Broadway show. Deborah Messing plays the co-writer of the show. And the show that she and her partner are working out, they're also trying to cast. And one of the women who is vying for the part, the lead role of Marilyn Monroe, is played by Megan Hilty, who is a...
Who is a legit Broadway stage talent.
She was in Wicked for a year. She was in the Broadway 9 to 5. She's... a belter, and, you know, she's kind of a bawdy-looking Marilyn Monroe type.
She's got lungs, let me put it that way.
She's got lungs.
That was Glenn's contribution to the discussion.
I'm coming.
The other woman trying out for the role is played by Katherine McPhee, who, if you are an American Idol watcher, or were, you may know Katherine McPhee as the second place from the, fifth season.
Sorry, now we're talking about my own.
That's your territory.
Fifth season of American Idol, where she came in second. Fundamentally, one of my problems with Smash, as I said from the minute I saw it, it is not credible to me that there would be a showdown between someone like Megan Hilty, who has a big Broadway voice and just a really big, powerful presence, and Katherine McPhee, who comes off to me like an American Idol contestant through and through and through and through, and who, I mean, in fairness, has very, very, very limited theater experience. She did one local production, I think, of Annie, Get Your Gun.
And she's done, you know, some small movie stuff, but it's not the same kind of acting.
No. And she doesn't come from Broadway musicals like Megan Hilty does, and I unfortunately feel like that shows. So when the character who's being played by Katherine McPhee is auditioning to be Marilyn Monroe, you see see her audition in front of the show producers, where she sings Beautiful by Christina Aguilera. Mm-hmm. And it's fine. It's the kind of thing you see in any good music school.
Every day is so wonderful, and suddenly it's hard to breathe. You are beautiful in every single way. Words won't bring you down. Don't you bring me down today, no matter what we do.
That scene is very American Idol-ish.
And it's very important that you see her audition so that you can see all the reaction shots of the producers who are communicating with their faces as hard as they can that she's really special. Yeah. Now, Megan Hilty, you are introduced to her by actually seeing her do it. And nobody really stands there going, oh my gosh, she's so amazing.
Right.
It's not as much about that.
It's show rather than tell.
It's more about her demonstrating how good she is by being good. You don't have to have all of those wow through people making faces.
One thing that I said when you and I were watching last night is that it's a little bit implausible for viewers to assume that Catherine McPhee is going to go toe-to-toe with Megan Hilty when we've already seen her on television unable to go toe-to-toe with Taylor Hicks.
All right, well, come on now.
Here's the thing. I think, and this is based on nothing except that first pilot, I think what's going to actually happen is that, this is my prediction in terms of the plot, I would think that Catherine McPhee is going to play Norma Jean in the musical, and the other person is going to play Marilyn Monroe. I think they're going to end up using both of them. That's just a
prediction. This is fun. Actually, there is a foreshadowing shot. If you look at the waiting room at the auditions, half of the girls are blonde, half of the girls are brunette, but they're all dressed in character, either as Norma Jean or as Marilyn. I like your idea.
Yeah.
Okay, but speaking of foreshadowing, was there a single scene in the pilot that you did not see coming in the scene before it?
Very few.
Starts off with Catherine McPhee singing Over the Rainbow.
Incidentally, it was one of her showstoppers on American
okay.
Idol.
Okay.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Dude. Patronize me, show. You think you know me, you don't know me. But I really like, you know what we haven't talked about is the look of the show. It's not just because of the apartment porn, although that is impressive.
Yes, it is.
It's just great to see a show being shot in New York and have characters walking down a New York street. I keep expecting them to find a dead body because I keep expecting a dog to find a dead body.
Only happens in the world of forensics that you actually see New York.
Teresa Riebeck has said in an NPR interview, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. that the reason you want to do this is because theater people are interesting and they're funny and they're passionate. And her words were, we are an interesting tribe.
Oh, good God.
Gross. Okay.
Yeah. You know, frankly, I am sick of all kinds of art. I'm sick of plays. I am sick of movies. And I may even be sick of TV shows about people who make art.
We've talked before about these screenplays, about guys who write screenplays.
Sure. Right. But yeah. I think this points up a very specific red flag about this show. Because, I mean, one of the reasons that it's kind of dizzying to be around theater people is because they're so intensely charismatic. Another reason is because they tend to suck the air out of the room.
It's literally dizzying.
Black holes of emotional need. They are avatars of neediness.
We say this as people who all hang out with creators all the time. And writers are no better.
That's the thing. They would say this about themselves loudly and in that weird animated way with jazz hands.
While shaking, because
they like to talk about themselves so much. Oh. But when you locate the show inside that bubble, the thing that really worries me about the show is the treatment of Deborah Messing's husband, who comes across as a total drip.
I have this big idea. Hey, Leo, when I say Maryland, what do you think?
Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay. Think a person. Maryland the person.
Marilyn Manson.
Which would be my point. Marilyn Monroe.
Who's Marilyn?
Marilyn the musical? Whoa. You and Tom are taking a break, I thought.
I'm not talking about us. I'm just talking in the abstract. You just said Marilyn the musical. Like Marilyn the musical.
I didn't say it like anything. I said it like it's not a bad idea if someone were looking for ideas, which you are not.
Well, how would you do it?
Oh, for crying out loud.
Don't get mad at me. I don't know.
You could do scenes from the movies. You could have a big group theater number. You have a baseball number.
That's what Tom said.
Everybody else who is not an artist is unpleasant.
Is like a killjoy.
Like the surly teen. I was glad to see that they installed the surly teen before the show left the factory floor. I was glad to see that.
Yep. It's a surly teen.
This is also the problem I had, tangent with Midnight in Paris, where all the artists are beautiful and interesting and troubled in fascinating ways, and everybody else is horrible.
It's where I have to bring up a great line that one Linda Holmes once said to me, which I don't think has ever been published before. You said that history is not written by the winners, it's written by the writers.
Right.
I did say that.
That is so incredibly true, and it's why, of course, creative types are always wildly overestimated.
Sure. You know what show neatly got around that very problem that is kind of similar in subject, if not in tone? Slings and Arrows. The way they did that was they made those people annoying.
Annoyingly neurotic.
And neurotic.
Well, and
we've only seen, I understand, we've only seen
the pilot.
Episode,
and I would be willing to bet that down the road, if the show lasts, Brian Darcy James, who plays the husband, will in fact turn out to be the rock who supports Crazy Lady when she gets in the middle of the crazy.
Right. We've said this about pilots a million times. It's very early. All you're really doing at this point is picking out what do you like, what do you not like. And I got to say, my other problem, which I am quite concerned about, I'm not into the music at all.
Okay.
And this is where Glee has the advantage of the fact that they were always using familiar songs, songs you knew. You know, no matter how bad you think their version of the song is, it's still a song you know, and you have that moment of recognition, like, oh, and yes, it's Mark Shaiman, and you know, it's Hairspray, and but when I was looking him up, though, I found this other key fact that I did want to mention: received an Emmy for co-writing Billy Crystal's medleys at the Academy Awards.
Oops.
And I thought, there's something in there that contains an element that is not for me.
Also, used to write for Bette Midler.
Yeah, that's you're not making your point any stronger there.
That's back on the plus side.
But to be fair, of the songs that are in the pilot of the show, there are several ballads and one kind of va-va-va-boom kind of baseball
and
baseball number.
And that was baseball number works.
That was the good number in the show.
Fellas. Yeah.
Fellas.
Is it?
Hey,
off the benches, it's Marilyn.
I just got a date.
She just got a date.
With baseball's Chilton Chilton.
The lucky so-and-so.
So run me round the bases, put me through my paces, and teach me all the things a slugger's lover should know. Just a little girl, I like being dainty and pretty. But now that I'm giving sports a whirl, I find I kinda like to get dirty.
Baby, what's that thing?
That's the team bullpen.
The baseball one was the only one that when I heard it again, I thought, oh, I kind of like that one hook.
It's
that
a lively choreographed
it's
number.
It's lively.
But
it's
not,
production
it's not this sort of stultifying stand still and sing American Idol performances.
Linda and I talked about this. Well, the American Idol performances notwithstanding, there's a scene where the first song they write for this Marilyn Monroe musical, there's a scene where they're doing a demo. Somebody records the demo and it goes viral.
On U-Lens.
U-Lens with a Z.
On the internets. You know, that song, to us, it hasn't got it.
That wouldn't even go bacterial.
Right. But when I watched it the second time, what maybe we didn't notice is they really only show you the induction of the song, which, when I listened to it the second time, it was very Cole Porter-ish. It's got some good DNA.
So you're asking me to assume
and then it shows you the last four bars of the song. It doesn't show you any of the middle. It doesn't show you a bridge. It doesn't give you any build. So I'm going to say I'm even holding off on that song because we're going to get that full song later, maybe.
So you're asking me to intuit a good song between the not very good beginning and the not very good end.
Hush
All
now.
The good stuff is the quiet part.
Linda Holmes.
And we actually once had a really good post on Monkey See from Mark Hirsch, who has been on the podcast, who wrote about the problem of trying to create a piece of fake art.
Yep.
And one of the things this was always talked about was Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. They had sketches that were supposed to be brilliant that weren't brilliant.
Right.
You have this problem anytime you're supposed to have a movie or a something about a song that's supposed to be great. The only one I've ever seen work, anyone know?
Mm-hmm.
Song that was appropriate to plot? That Thing You Do. That song is good enough to be the song in that story.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's catchy enough, I should
As
say,
we have
to
discussed,
be the
yes.
song in that story.
Well, one thing we haven't talked about yet is that this is essentially a workshop for what they're hoping to turn into an actual Broadway
yeah,
show, well, yes?
At least that was one of the concepts. I'm not sure if they're sticking with that idea, but yeah, the idea was, as with, I guess, some other reality shows, you know, cooking-related reality shows, if they cook up a Broadway musical that sort of works during the writing of this television show, then they will spin it off and turn it into a real Broadway musical.
I don't
musical.
See it yet.
Don't see it yet, but again,
we've only seen the pilot.
I'm thinking it depends on how true to the actual process they are, because, I mean, if we see a song like the baseball song and it gets cut because it's not working, I mean, that would make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, wondering how much they're going to actually commit to that, or if we're just going to keep seeing new songs so that this ostensible play is going to be like
70 songs
Angels in America.
Which sort of brings us to the... Right, it's a 7-hour musical with you. Which brings us to the other question, which is, how do you sustain a show like this over several seasons? You get a new musical every season?
Yes, that would be the American Horror Story approach.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Right now, what they said is, I think it's the first season is supposed to be up through their tryout. I think it's a 3-season set of, it'll be up to this, and then up to this, and then up to this.
Interesting.
That would end with the actual season that's on Broadway by the time they're in the third season.
Anybody else have any problem with Deborah Messing's scarves? Anything else? Anybody else notice
hey,
that?
No.
Well, what do you got?
She has not scarves. The director has a scarf. Yeah. Megan Hilty at one point.
Everybody's about the scarves.
She has scarves that are trailing the floor. She's like Doctor Who. She's like Isadora Duncan. She's got some kind of botched tracheotomy or something.
Speaking of the bescarved, Linda, how long would you say after they introduced the director?
Did 45 seconds.
It was not that long. Did I lean over to you and say, has he slept with Catherine McPhee yet? He's so clearly going to try.
45 seconds, maybe.
I just felt like there was not a moment of this show that I had not seen before, other than seeing like Black Swan and a few other things. I can't even name like 50 things with this plot that I've seen, and I felt like I had seen every scene 50 times, including like the family from Iowa, and it's like, we want you back on our Midwestern corn farm. You know, it just had this.
There's this great moment where Catherine McPhee is like, I don't want to fail and go back to Iowa. And when I watched it the first time with another friend of mine, we talked about how on television and in movies, returning to the Midwest is always what happens to you if you're a complete failure.
Useless.
Like, I don't want to go back to Ohio. I don't want to go back to Indiana. What if I have to go back to Wisconsin? It's, like, it's been done to every Midwestern state. Every Midwestern state is like, stay in New York, you big jerk. Nobody wants you at the Corn Palace.
Stay out of our culverts.
NBC's strategy for its first hit in a while is to alienate the entire Middle West.
I don't want to go back to Iowa. Anyway,
so Smash, we're not entirely convinced, but I'm going to give it a chance for a while.
I think it's definitely worth giving a chance. And if you are interested in giving it a chance, it's currently on Hulu and iTunes. But this coming Monday on NBC is its actual premiere date on the actual literal television. Anyway, what we're going to talk about next involves reading.
Wait, how did that happen?
How do all of you feel about reading?
I'm pro it.
I've done it.
I like it.
I like the fact that I'm kept in for the discussion of Smash.
you seem like a Smash kind of guy.
Well, we needed to butch it up somehow.
Steven's areas of expertise include Smash, but not reading. I feel like that's fair.
I think we actually have to throw you out.
Do we have someone who could come in?
Maybe we do.
Do we have somebody vastly superior?
I think maybe we do. Why don't you introduce yourself? Who is sitting in Steven's chair? Who are you?
My name is Kung Fu Panda, too. You knew it was coming.
I did. After Kung Fu Panda 1.
Steven arranged it.
Yeah. Who are you really?
My name is Parul Sehgal. I'm the books editor at NPR.
And Parul joined us a couple months ago at NPR, and we're incredibly excited, and she reads books.
Yeah.
She reads a lot of books, don't you?
I do read a lot.
And she writes
Admit
about
it.
Them.
And I do write about them.
Where were you before NPR?
I was at Publishers Weekly.
And what did you do there?
I was a reviews editor, so basically combed through mountains of books and wrote and edited tiny capsule reviews.
Yeah.
And you write for some other joint that has a book review. What's it called?
I write for the New York Times Book Review and pretty much any place that will have me. So just no shame in my game.
Well, we asked you here to talk about, or, you know, we were sort of having this wide-ranging discussion. I think Glenn was finding it pretty
books,
suitable.
You like them? I think we need to pare it down.
Yeah.
We got talking about a variety of things, but one of them was a Tumblr post that went up that was called The Hierarchy of Book Publishing, and it was the Top 100. And it started with brand name authors, like Stephen King and people like that. And then it went down, and some of it was concepts, and some of it was writers, and some of it was websites or publications. NPR was number 21. And the New Yorker was number 23. So,
wow.
Take that, Eustace Tilly.
Take that, Eustace Tilly. But we got talking about the fact that there really is, in books, just like there is in book publishing, there tend to be all these different layers of kinds of books. Now, Perul, you would know what I'm talking about because, you know, obviously the kinds of books that they cover in the New York Times Book Review does not always include every kind of book that one might read.
No, absolutely. I think there's been this steady tension in, especially in reading. I mean, I think it's in every kind of culture, high or low, what we enjoy and what we feel like we should enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had really, my first week here, I had a great conversation with Linda, and she said that she loved ebooks because it was weeding out the people that bought books to keep on their shelves.
Right.
So it's actually readers buying books and people who read a tremendous amount. I'm so apologetic about my interest in this because it's catnip. I find this fascinating. This is my Kung Fu Panda. So I'm going to be a little bit, I'm going to be a little boring for like 2 seconds as I read aloud from this pre-prepared statement. The current iteration started in 2002.
Okay. No.
So, no, but it did. It did start in 2002. Okay. So Jonathan Franzen, a.k.a. the crankiest man in America, mm-hmm. published this essay, I think some of you will remember, called Mr. Difficult, basically saying that there were two kinds of writers in America, writers sort of like the modernist kind who wanted to say that good writing was writing that required effort, that was hard, that you had to read and reread. And then there were writers, contract writers, that were interested in your pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
He put himself firmly in that camp. Somebody else responded in Harper's, somebody else responded, and everybody sort of cried and went to their corners. And yeah. Four people really enjoyed this debate. I was two of them. I loved it. But yeah, I mean, I think it'll always be there. I think it's there in movies, too. You know, I mean, my mm-hmm. two favorite movies of the year were Bridesmaids and Tree of Life.
Yeah.
You know, completely irreconcilable.
Right. Yeah, they are.
This is why Perul keeps, of the books that come in over the transom, Perul keeps, you know, the high tone literature over here and How to Knit Your Own Cat.
Yeah.
Sitting right there on the corner of her desk.
Well, the thing that's really interesting, if you look at the despair in publishing over what's going to happen to us and all that stuff, you know, a good chunk of what's actually propping up publishing and bookstores and all that stuff is all the people who are coming in and they're buying a gazillion romance novels and mystery novels and cookbooks and, you know, all that stuff that's not like high-toned art.
Yeah, the first people who adopted ebooks were romance publishers. Mm-hmm. And according to Harlequin, they said that their readers don't like to be left alone without a book.
Well, and
so
I
had to provide some steady. It's like crack. That's a problem. You can't be left alone without a book.
And I read romance novels on
not that I've done crack. I don't do crack. I don't do crack.
I understand it's whack.
I read romance novels on my Kindle. And the other nice thing about it, and I am, you know, far, far, far from the first person to note this, is that people do not judge you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only thing you have to make sure of is that the person on the subway behind you is not actually looking over your shoulder and reading the book, because then it's awkward.
You spend a lot of time worrying about subway judgment, do you, Linda?
Well, I do. No, well, no, not so much subway judgment, except I just don't want anybody to get the wrong idea.
Ah.
Like, it's not my fault that I got to the sexy part on the subway. I'm not, like, a gross person.
Okay, okay.
I don't, like, sit on the subway reading sexy.
Waiting.
Like, that's not my thing. So, you know, but other than that, you don't have people sort of looking at the covers of your right. books and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've always been mystified by the distinction between literary fiction and genre fiction, because I've always thought that the people who read literary fiction and look down on genre fiction do not understand that literary fiction is a genre. You just take a wizard and substitute infidelity. You take an epic space battle and you substitute in a tiny epiphany. You take a dead body and substitute an ashtray slowly filling with rainwater in a trailer park.
He's reading from something.
I am.
Wow.
No.
It's always struck me as silly. And that said, I've been asking a lot of my friends who read a lot of stuff, specifically about Jennifer Weiner and Jodi Picoult, because I don't read those.
Mm-hmm.
And what a friend of mine, Mara, was saying, who was a voracious reader, she was saying she loves those books, loves them, but does not consider them in the same camp that she would consider Alice Munro or Mary Gateskill or anything like that. And I asked her to pin it down. What's the difference specifically? And she said, I know how those books are going to end. That's the difference. That's the useful difference for her. And I thought that was kind of interesting because when you think of something like science fiction, you think of big ideas, workmanlike prose. And certainly that's true for somebody like Asimov who couldn't put a sentence together to save his life. I mean, on a line-by-line level, he's filled with things like, what? He ejaculated? Like a lot of that kind of really basic, terrible writing.
See, that's what you don't read on the subway.
Right. But there's also China Meville who has beautiful writing that addresses sort of fantastic conceits. I'm not going to say that these distinctions are fading, but I think there's a lot of really interesting writers who don't care.
Right. Pearl, what do you read these days?
I read everything, and I think...
Do you really, or do you just read, like, Linda, super everything. High and then, like, slightly less
it's
high?
It's just Proust. These Proust and crack.
Just Proust and crack.
Proust and crack. Just
the Pearl story.
Some smeared eyeliner.
That is totally your lifetime movie.
A Madeleine.
Yeah.
No, I think that there are lots of different kinds of pleasure. I think your friend Mara is right, and I think that most people actually read a lot of different things for a lot of different reasons, and I think that most kinds of pleasure are completely valid. I think last week's podcast you were talking about the distinction between what we love and what we like. And I think that I think it applies to reading.
At some point around college, around like freshman year of college, I began to think of fiction reading not necessarily that it was work, but that it was something where you were either going to react to it correctly or incorrectly. And it began to feel to me like when I would go to freshman English and, you know, we would talk about a novel, that there was sort of a right answer, that you were supposed to come up with what's the answer to why this is important, what's the answer to what this character's motivation is. And I stopped trusting my own reactions to things, and so it felt the whole time like I wasn't just reacting like I do, for example, to music. I was sitting there thinking, okay, what am I supposed to be getting from this? And I sort of became so obsessed with intent and why is this written this way, which, of course, the more writing you do yourself, the more obsessed you become with why is this written this way instead of that way. And I really became a person who did not read very much fiction. Because when I read nonfiction or essays, you know, I feel like the communication is more straightforward and I don't feel as much like I'm trying to, like I'm being tested on whether I figure it out.
Right.
Whereas there are certain kinds of novels, especially novels, not to go back to The Marriage Plot, but especially to go to when it's novels like I have found the first half of The Marriage Plot.
This is why I'm here. I think so she can continue reacting.
Where it's like nothing is happening unless there's something happening that I'm not understanding. Which is partly true because, you know, so much of that book is steeped in literary culture that because I'm not a voracious reader of fiction, I'm not necessarily the ideal audience for. But I get obsessed with these things. Like when Glenn talks about the ashtray filling with rainwater, I become obsessed with, like, what am I supposed, like, why is it, what am I missing about this story, and why is nothing happening?
Well, wet ashtray, for one. That's A.
I don't know. Help me, Pearl.
I think it's problematic whenever we don't trust our instincts. I feel that way about music. I feel like a complete poser when I have to talk about, you know, I'm scrambling for things, I'm reaching for things, for reasons why I like something, why I should like something, but I don't know. I do feel, I think, that reading difficult things sometimes can make you a better reader, you know? I definitely attempt and try different books and fail and, you know, have tried to climb the mountain of Sebald many times and run away, you know? But I think,
but
yeah, it's important.
You just keep reading?
I'm a better person, Linda.
I'm
much better person.
Sure,
totally
clearly.
Are.
But Linda, you did the same thing with Moby Dick a while back.
That's true.
Oh, that's amazing.
You clawed your way through that.
Claw my way through it. At the beginning, I was mostly obsessed with how different it was in structure than anything that I would read now. The fact that it would set up, like, I will now have a chapter about the place where we were staying, and then that would be the chapter about the place where you're staying. And I'm used to that in nonfiction. Like, now we will have a chapter about the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yep.
But I'm not as used to it where it's like, and now the chapter about the kitchen. And then they'll say, when I talk about the kitchen, I must start by whatever. And I wasn't used to that. And obviously, Moby Dick is kind of an extreme example of that, since it has all the chapters that are like, and now whale heads.
That's right. Hooks to render whale fat.
And it's like recipes for whale candles. And I'm like, I can't, right? But I finished it. And the problem is, it's not like a math problem where you can ever find out whether you got it right. So it's like, you just have to do it. and then maybe you figured it out. Mm. And if you didn't, maybe you wasted your time.
So you're talking about the distinction between culture and popular culture, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. The kind of modern condition where the stuff that we can easily grasp and talk about kind of gets universally disseminated and universally
discussed.
Well,
and the problem is the only way that you become better at something like this, though, is that you do it and then you see how you did. And if you got it wrong, then the next time maybe you know better. Mm. To me, if I read something and then it's like, you just never, maybe you missed the point completely.
No, I disagree.
I think the exercise, you missed the point.
No, I think the exercise is always worthwhile in itself because you'll be having epiphanies for the rest of your life about things that happened in Moby Dick.
It's my overwhelming fear of missing the point.
But again, you're talking about the modern condition of feeling that something is going on here that I do not get.
Right.
I do not get this thing.
I mean, it's like what you guys were saying last time about the success of certain Hollywood movies that flatter audiences in a particular way and sort of massage their egos and massage like larger social certainties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tree of Life was just, like that weird dinosaur baby came out and I was like, I don't know what to feel right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what I'm feeling.
That's a great point. Yeah. That's a great point. And the thing is, with a movie, I'm much more likely to be like, I understand what's going on here. I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
Whereas with books, I think because I stopped reading fiction, I don't have the confidence to say, I understand this. I just don't like it. It's right, just not for me. I feel as I have over and over with the marriage plot. I'm like, am I reading it wrong? Someone help me understand. Whereas with the Tree of Life, a lot of the rest of it I really enjoyed. But that part, I was kind of like, yeah, I get what you're trying to do, but it's too early in the movie for this much of this, and I got it. I just didn't like it.
It's also kind of what satire and parody exist to do, which is to take something like an institution and break it apart and kind of get it on your side. Make fun of it. So we are collectively making fun of this thing. So an article that was making fun of Moby Dick, it's existing to A, get you into the thing, and B, kind of break down the wall between you and it.
Yeah.
I just finished a really good book called Angel Maker by Nick Harkaway, which is a humorous writing. And there's something magical about humorous writing that really gets you on the character side, on the author side, and it takes a lot of the sort of fancy-pantsy stuff and just really humanizes it in a really interesting way. And that's why I think the funny parts of Moby Dick work better than the non-funny parts of Moby Dick.
Yeah, there are some funny parts.
There are.
There are some funny parts. Not so much the everyone dying, but some of the other parts.
We find our humor where we can.
Tell me something good to read right now, Pearl.
Okay, it's coming out. It's not out yet. Are You My Mother by Alison Bechdel. I mean, she's, if you're talking about blending high and low culture together, nobody does it better. Her last book was Fun Home, and it was an investigation of her dad. She wasn't sure if her dad committed suicide or not, and after he died, she discovered he'd been gay and closeted and had this secret life, and she was coming out and realizing that she was queer herself, and this sort of detective story into her own origins. And she does it using great books, but not great books in a boring way the way I make them sound. She makes it sound like electric, and sort of there's a reason why they're still around. And she reads them like the way that people used to climb Everest, because they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And she just wants to own them in this way that I think only outsiders can feel about high culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this the sense of ownership and wanting it.
Is this straight up prose, or is
this
a graphic
novel? Okay. And it's gorgeous, and it sort of like has lots of the same characters you'll recognize from Dykes to Watch Out for, her long running strip.
And when can we get it?
Well, if you're in with me, I'll do what I can.
It's coming out in May, right?
It is coming out in May.
Yeah.
This is Alison Bechdel, by the way. Alison Bechdel, who will be known to certain segments of the movie-going population as the author of what's referred to as the Bechdel Test. Which, to pass the Bechdel Test, a film or TV show must meet the following criteria. It must include at least two women who have at least one conversation about something other than a man.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I think they both have to have names.
I think
that's another part of
it. Let's hope.
I mean, otherwise you're left with, and then she runs into the woman at the bus stop, and they talk whether the bus just left.
True.
Do you know what I mean?
Fair enough.
So I think they both have to have names.
So we come to the conclusion that high art, good. Low art, good.
That's right. Read more.
Some things not always like we expect.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely.
Yep. Love what you love.
All right. Well, you can come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us how you feel about books in general and what you're reading right now in particular. Or you can come and find us on the blog at Monkey See. Pearl, thank you so much.
Guys.
Awesome job.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Ashen with fear.
You are the best. All right. Well, now that we are finished with books, we have tagged back in. Oh, look who it is.
Now, I wanted to talk about, you know, because I don't want to be left out of the literary discussion. And I wanted to talk about this.
So you also wanted to talk about Are You My Mother?
I wanted to talk about this Laffy Taffy wrapper I read. It contained a delicious pun.
It's good to, you know, it's good to see you back around the table for our final segment, which is What is Making Us Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Rutger Hauer is on Twitter. Rutger Ha Ha, because apparently Rutger Hauer was taken.
Rutger Ha Ha.
He's not crazy pants yet, but just hold on.
Oh,
he will be very soon. Right now, he's just still trying to get verified, and he has,
aren't we all?
He has revealed... he just keeps throwing out these little tidbits. The tidbit he revealed recently is that he's never seen Blade Runner because he was too embarrassed.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you're just loving that.
I'm just hanging in there. Yeah, that's all I got.
Yeah. You're writing a book.
Yeah, that's right.
Not much time for being happy. Good Trey God. Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Greg Berlanti, the guy from Dawson's Creek and the guy from Brothers and Sisters
Everwood.
And all of that. Yeah, all that stuff. Just cut a deal with USA for a miniseries called Political Animals, which is about someone who sounds an awful lot like Hillary Clinton, former First Lady, Secretary of State.
Sound a little like her.
A little bit, yep. It will air this summer, and they don't have it cast yet. So what's making me happy this week is to play casting games. Who is going to play former First Lady, much like Hillary Clinton, who is running the State Department, and who, incidentally, in a way that's not quite like Hillary Clinton, apparently she's going to be recently divorced. So she's trying to sort of keep her... the rest of her family together
know.
And all that.
And,
hey, now.
Not coming out this summer.
So I'm just assuming, and we can invite the audience to come to the Facebook page and weigh in with suggestions
sure.
here. Assuming they're not going to hire Glenn Close
right.
or Sigourney Weaver.
Right.
Annette Bening is too highfalutin, I think. Who needs to play this part?
I feel like Annette Bening is sort of medium-falutin.
Yeah, I think
really?
She's she might mid-falutin.
Be up for it.
Yeah. I mean, she'd be awesome, but I figure she's got too many Oscars to
Kay Ballard
game, right?
busy?
Sure.
Oh, fun. I'm going to argue, actually, for Holland Taylor.
Sure. Excellent.
Or maybe even, I would like to see this happen, Jane Lynch.
Wow.
I would like to see Jane Lynch play an actual dramatic, no wackadoo, no big jazz hands, hard ass.
Huh. That's a very interesting idea.
Very anyway, come to the blog or to the Facebook page and tell us who
there's nothing else they could fall back on Holland Taylor, given that she will appear in anything.
Yep. Yeah, there is
true.
That, apparently.
Even Two and a Half Men.
The other tiny little thing that's making me happy, I saw this yesterday. A reporter friend of mine in Florida started passing around this video. And as of today, Tuesday, it is on every major international news site. So I hope that by the end of the week, the Samuel Jackson parodies will have begun. There are giant pythons eating everything in the Everglades. The footage of these snakes is fantastically creeptastic.
This came up at the morning NPR news meeting the other day, and we were all pretty blown away by what they were.
There's no roadkill in the Florida Everglades anymore because the snakes are eating all the records.
Well, they were talking about the fact that apparently deer are walking up to the water. Like, this is the way that Andrew Prince from the NPR Science Desk explained it, was the deer walk up, what's a python? And then, hump, and then they're gone. So it is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, a few things. One, it is our diamond anniversary.
So it is.
Hey!
75th episode of Pop Culture Happy
Hour.
Wait.
That is why you're being phased out.
I was going to say, wait, you count?
That's right.
Hey, you know, I was a mathlete.
Yeah. And please, Stephen, diamond.
Our diamond anniversary. Mm-hmm. Correct. Very excited, as always, about Chicken Bowl 16, my annual Super Bowl party / fried chicken eating contest,
true.
Which is now about to have its 16th iteration, which I'm, even though the Packers are not in the game.
Are you going to Skype that or something? Because how else are people going to participate?
Can we live tweet
it? Throw yourselves a Super Bowl.
Live tweet.
I got something to recommend that people can actually experience. The thing that I really wanted to talk about is I got to witness firsthand Martin Scorsese wildest non-sexual and non-violent fantasy come to life.
And I am very curious about how this is going to go.
You know how last week, Glenn, you talked about you wanted to watch Julian Fellowes watch him down.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I wanted to watch Martin Scorsese watch my kids in action when I took them to Hugo. And, of course, one of the central plot points of Hugo is the film Le Voyage dans la Lune, A Trip to the Moon, the 1902 silent film.
Georges Méliès.
Méliès. Méliès?
Yes.
Méliès.
No, French. So I took my kids to see Hugo, and I realized, actually, as I was driving home from the movie theater, that I have in my possession a DVD copy of the film.
Why?
Because the French band Air was commissioned to write and record and perform a new score for the restoration of this 110-year-old movie.
This is like the Giorgio Moroder Metropolis.
So they spent like 17 years painstakingly hand-restoring...
Trip to the Moon.
A Trip to the Moon. Because I am writing the first listen for the soundtrack album by Air, I happen to have a DVD copy of the movie with Air's music attached. And so I said to the kids... You liked Hugo. Would you like to watch this 110-year-old French silent film? And they actually did. And they were actually excited, and they actually sat riveted. And my son in particular, who's about to turn 11, was really interested. And like, he was looking for Georges Méliès in the film, like trying to figure out, well, he has a little beard and a mustache. That's probably, he looks kind of like, you know, Ben Kingsley or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's probably him. And I just imagined Martin Scorsese, like all Martin Scorsese wants out of that like $200 million movie was for some little boy to watch it.
And it was you.
To take an interest in the films of Georges Méliès. I mean, that's all that movie is it's like, please watch the films of Georges Méliès. And so I got to watch Martin Scorsese have his dream come true.
That is excellent.
Awesome.
I am glad that that is making you so happy. What is making me happy this week is going to sound a little bit grim.
Grimmer than Python.
I was going to say grimmer than deer. I would just like to revise and extend my remarks. I'm not happy about the deer getting eaten. I'm happy about the spectacle of giant pythons overrunning half of Central Florida.
We like the idea of deer being swallowed whole by pythons.
Right. Can I be happy already?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so two pieces of news broke this week, both of which on their own have a note of grimness. One of which is that NBC is considering an Office spinoff that would send Dwight Schrute, played by Rainn Wilson, off to his beet farm, and we would follow Dwight on his beet farm. I do not think this is a good idea. Now, I would not have thought it was a good idea to follow Frasier to Seattle either, so what do I know?
Take
but
that
I will
for
tell
what it's
you,
worth.
Or necessarily to remake The Office.
But I will tell you, I am highly skeptical. The other piece of news was that Mindy Kaling has a deal for a new show. She plays Kelly Kapoor on The Office and is a writer and has a deal for a new show, I believe, at Fox. Her new show, she plays a doctor, and supposedly it's very Bridget Jonesy, and I only know it from reading about it in a couple of places. So I'm not an expert on it, but apparently she has a new deal. The thing that is making me happy about this is that those two pieces of news combined make me think that they are getting ready to wrap up that show. And as much as I have loved it, and I have been sort of revisiting parts of it recently and been reminded how much I really, really enjoyed it and appreciated lots of it, not just the first. You know, people will say, oh, the first two seasons. No, it was, I enjoyed a lot of that show for a long time.
At least 2 through 5.
But they have not found a post-Steve Carell direction. I don't think they're going to find one. I think everybody's ready to go. And when Mike Schur left that show, he went and did Parks and Rec, which is great. And it makes me think that's a lot of talent that you can free up and they can go do other stuff that's really cool. And I think the time has come to drop the curtain. And I was one of the people who, when Steve Carell left, I said, not yet. There's lots of reason to believe that there's life in it. But the way this season has been going, I just don't think it's going to happen. And so to me, the sense that they're going to maybe wind it up sort of makes me happy, because it's a lot of really talented people who I look forward a lot to what they're going to do, that I suspect will be more satisfying than the product that they're making right now. So it's a sort of a wistful,
I was gonna say,
happy.
What's making me happy is the circle of life.
it's the TV circle of life. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that is the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Parul at Parul Segal, which is P-A-R-U-L underscore S-E-H-G-A-L. And I'm sure she talks about all kinds of brainiac things. It's going to make you such a genius. You can also follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, is responsible for the happy music you are hearing right now, and we really, really appreciate it. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or come to the blog at Monkey C. Thanks to all of you guys for being here this week.
Thank you.
And of course, we thank Parul for dropping in and making us all a little bit smarter.
Absolutely.
And we will see all of you back here next week.